Okay, you were describing how it felt to actually be working in hotel situations, but not being able to use the facilities.
Anywhere I had interface with the public, the white public. That's one thing about Stevens Lee. We had something instilled in us that was unusual. I mean, we didn't feel inferior to anybody. If anything, we had a superior attitude. We were better in some instances than most. We felt complete too. We were accepted. We had no fear, qualm if we came in contact with someone to converse with them or whatever, you know, would take place. Stevens Lee had put something into us that I don't see today in schools.
How do you think Stevens Lee was able to accomplish that?
Unusual faculty. Unusual. If you read the history, you find that most of them had their masters. Mm-hmm. Some were working on their doctorates. And I guess because they weren't able to get jobs in other schools and other places, Stevens Lee became sort of a focal point for teachers. They wanted to come into the system. Albert Manley, who had come from the Caribbean islands and had been educated in other schools, had come to Virginia and was going to a school there, but he heard of this school in North Carolina and how well it prepared its student, and he came here as a young boy, and of course later went on to graduate and come back as principal of the school, and later on as superintendent of Negro public schools in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. But it had a reputation. Mm-hmm. It had a reputation, and the quality of it, and the teachers had been educated in so many different schools in other states, and they brought all that back to us. You know, in the mountains in Asheville, you're sitting on a plateau that's completely surrounded by mountains. You are enclosed. And these teachers had gone out from here and gone beyond the mountains and seen different things. And when they came back, they brought it to us. You know? And of course, we were very receptive of it. And like I say, it was given to us in so many forms. Our music, we learned the national anthem and whatever song you're supposed to learn, mm-hmm. but then we learned all the black songs too, the black musicians and the plays written by blacks, and of course you get the story and the history, and it was just Stevens Lee was just a focal point for the whole community. I mean, and when anything was held at Stevens Lee, it packed.
Hmm. With everyone.
Everyone.
So, tell me, what are the most important qualities that you think you took from your experience at Stevens Lee individually?
Qualities?
Well, in other words, how are you influenced?
To be self-sufficient.
Okay.
That was one thing. Yeah. Not to depend on anyone or anything. Yourself, prepare yourself. You know, of course, my family had always told me not to be too anxious to speak, to control myself. Know thyself, control thyself, give thyself.
Your parents taught you that.
Yeah. Oh, we got all that. Yeah, long before school. Mm-hmm. So never to be too quick to speak or outspoken, but if asked to speak, or if it was necessary to speak, then do so. Mm-hmm. You know, and say something. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I was very forward, very outspoken. I didn't shy away from anybody, and I still don't. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about did you go to your senior prom?
Yes. And we had junior senior prom. You were allowed to go your junior year, then the senior year, the juniors gave you the prom.
Yeah. Did you go to both?
Yes.
Who did you take?
Well, first prom, when I was a junior, I hadn't really thought about going. But my teacher, Mrs. Tolliver, asked me if I would escort a young lady who was a senior, and she didn't seem to have a boyfriend at the time. So I agreed, and I took her. She was a year or two older than I was. Yeah, very pretty girl.
How did you get there?
By taxi cab.
Took a taxi?
Mm-hmm.
I talked to somebody who said they had to catch the bus, actually.
Yeah, some used to catch the bus, but see, I was where I worked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I could go in style.
Yeah,
and I carried a little corsage.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I did the right thing.
Oh, that's good.
Then, of course, my senior prom was my sweetheart.
Right.
Yeah,
your,
I carried her.
Yeah.
We were classmates anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell me about graduation.
Oh, wow. Yeah. You look forward to graduating, but then there was a lot of sadness. You knew that was the end of an era. And, of course, a lot of them were going off to school. And there were those like me that didn't know what they were going to do. Money was just out the question as far as tuition and all. And I wanted to pursue drama.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps
you wanted education.
Mm-hmm. And I found out that the school in West Virginia State had a drama course there.
Mm-hmm.
What I didn't know then, and I don't think blacks knew then, I believe there is a law that if you live, say, in this state, if you wanted to take a particular course, and if it was not offered at a college that you could attend, that the state would pay your tuition. I didn't know that.
Hmm.
And there was no school here in North Carolina that I could go to, a black school
that had
offered
drama.
So
you could have probably...
Had I known.
Had them pay for you to go.
Somewhere. Yeah, but I didn't. So I had to struggle through 2 years of trying to stay in school. Well, right there at the Chapel Hill, Claude McKissick from Asheville, graduate Stevens Lee, he was the first to integrate the law school there, he and Harold Epps.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we didn't know. Those things weren't made available to, I don't get it was known in the black community, some of the options you could select. So, but a lot of them did go off, and a lot of them finished school. And, of course, gobs of them became principals and teachers, doctors, lawyers, distinguished military people.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Lee really turned out a crop, I'm telling you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sounds like
it. Oh, yes.
Excuse me. So you were at West Virginia State for 3 years?
2 years.
2 years?
48, 49, 50.
And why did you leave? Why did you leave?
Money was one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I came home and my girlfriend had attended Xavier in New Orleans. And unfortunately, her father died.
Mm-hmm.
And she wasn't able to return to school. I couldn't really afford to return. So we opted for marriage.
Mm-hmm. So you got married then in 1950?
In 50.
Okay. And then what was your next move?
From there, I guess the biggest thing, I became a father. And from then I left with my friend Roy McCullough in 52, I believe, and went to Akron, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I got my job at Babcock & Wilcox, sweeping the floor, mind you, for $1.40.
Mm-hmm.
I was making 75 cents an hour at the Citizen Times here in Asheville. Mm-hmm. And that was twice the rate, so I stayed. And I've always been trainable, so... I didn't know what I wanted to do. I used to walk around and watch the men at the machines, and I never liked machinery. I worked all my life in factories, but I never liked machinery. And I didn't like the lathes and the drill presses and all that. It scared me. But I always noticed the welders. Nobody ever bothered the welders. And they worked at their own pace because that's a teacher's job, and it's, well, you got to be exact to, you know, the weld. You had to be able to run a good bead, as they say. And I used to watch them, and I made friends with some of the welders.
Hmm.
And I used to sweep and clean their area the cleanest. So they let me borrow their helmets and their electrodes at lunchtime, and I practiced. And the foreman saw me and sent me off to welding school there at the factory. And so I became a welder, and worked my way up to what they call a certified A welder. The government has to certify you to work on certain things. That's how I got to work on the Nautilus submarine parts, parts of the Nautilus submarine.
So how long were you in Akron?
About 3.5 years, something like that.
You did all that in 3.5 years. That's pretty quick. And did you move to Detroit after that?
I came home for a short sprint. I stayed here, came back. I got it. It was a layoff. Having been an A welder, they call it, you had A, B, C, D, E, and E was the lowest. I had worked up to the A welder. Well, when the layoffs came, you could not bump up. You could bump down. Although I was young in seniority, I was high in grade. And that saved my job for a long time, you know. The big layoff came, and so finally got down to where I was welding for a construction crew. And that meant I had to go down in the holes and weld, or either climb the ladder to the towers and weld. And I stuck with it till I finally got a layoff. And I came home for about 6 months, I guess, we came here, and then I moved, went to Detroit.
Okay, and you were in Detroit from what years
ago? Oh, I think it was 54, somewhere along in there. I went to work at Burroughs Corporation. Worked there for 11 months, and the first layoff in 17 years came with Burroughs, and I got caught in that. But luckily, I put in an application with the city and the post office. So I was only off work for like a month or so, and the post office called me to work. And I put in 3 years at the post office, and that was a hell place to work. Oh, San Quentin couldn't have been any worse than,
really?
Than working at the annex department in Detroit, Michigan. It was something. You were treated just terrible. And I was a sub temp. I never knew how long I was going to work. If the mail was heavy, you might work 11, 12 hours. If the mail was light, they'd send you home in two. So you never knew, but I stayed at that until I got back at Burroughs. I loved Burroughs. That was an adding machine, calculators, later computers. And having worked there, I worked at the post office, too. I kept both jobs. And unfortunately, I got sick and had to go into the hospital. And I guess I was out of work for about 3 months. But I was on a medical from Burroughs. Fortunately, I got back just in time to get covered by insurances. And, of course, that was a down spiral for me as far as savings. I'd lost everything then, trying to keep afloat. But I had heard that a major automobile company was buying out an electronic company. And word got out that it was going to be Burroughs was going to be sold because they were having a little difficulties. So I went to Ford, to Chrysler, and to General Motors and put in an application to work. I was working production control at Burroughs. And Ford Motor Company, Tracking Division, all their records were manual. And they were just beginning to upgrade and go on computer with records. I haven't worked at Burroughs, had studied a little computer programming at Wayne, trying to advance there in production control. And of course with that they hired me. And I was to go into production control with the idea I would work to put their records on computer. But I ran into segregation again. Superintendent Hardesty.
Hardesty?
Yeah. Who had never had a N-word work in his department and didn't want one. He didn't know that I was black. They told him they were sending a production control analyst. That was my title, production control analyst. And they had hired me, and I'd already given Burroughs notice. So when I went to Ford's, then I ran into him. I was in limbo because they didn't know what to do. They had to hire me because they had would have a suit on their hands. You're naturally, you see.
Right, right.
You'd given Burroughs notice. So he gave me a job way at the back of the whole complex on the shipping dock.
My goodness.
But,
were you the only black person working
in a white shirt with a tie.
And what were you doing exactly?
Well, I still carry the title of production control, but I was really keeping track of all the transmissions coming in and parts being shipped out. What it was at that time, we had a round robin between Antwerp, Belgium, Basildon, England, and Highland Park, Michigan. They were tractor plants.
Mm-hmm.
And one plant would make the transmissions and ship to us, and we'd make engine parts and ship to them. It was, you know, so the logistics was keeping up with what was coming in and what the requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kept records as to what was on hand, what was needed, what was on ship. So a lot of time I had to do a lot of talking by telephone and faxing, telex we call it then, to England and to Antwerp, Belgium. So I got to know quite a few people in the pipeline.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that went on quite a while. Then Ford started making all types of different model tractors, and they had state contracts, and the contracts with the states, each state has its own colors.
Go on.
Okay. So you needed someone to coordinate these colors, because you had to tell the paint line what model's coming up, what color you wanted, different color fenders, different color, all kinds of colors, the rainbow. And like I say, I kept pretty good records, I had pretty good recommendations, so they put me out on the floor as a, they made a title called the paint line coordinator. And wow, was that a job. Because every different model was different, and if it was gas or diesel, it had a different part number.
Mm-hmm.
I used to study numbers and catalogs, and I got to the place where I could identify a part from sight, which many of them couldn't do. Sometimes mm-hmm. it could just be a very little deviation between a diesel part and a gasoline part. Something mechanically had to go in that hole that they didn't see it. I did.
Hmm.
So I developed spreadsheets and things of that nature to keep up with the different models and types.
Wow.
And I became coordinator. And I worked at that and coordinated that line till they opened this new place called Parts Distribution Center. The world's largest warehouse under one roof on one floor. 3 million square feet of story.
Mm.
Awesome. They had advanced me to a level 6 because I had to interface with a lot of foremen, and a lot of times a lot of the supervisors, which were white, didn't want to take your word for something or would try to say that whatever you told them was erroneous, and I knew better. So in order for me to have some kind of authority, they made me the same grade as a foreman so I could talk straight across.
Hmm.
And of course, that was fun for me
because
I could get even now.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. And later on, this place opened up. They were looking for people to go out, and they heard about this guy at Highland Park with the paint line and asked me to come out and interview for supervisor of sheet metal and priming. And that was something. I'd never seen a place that large in all my born days.
Mm.
Now, I'm from Asheville, you know.
Right, right. So what year were you hired at Ford?
In 64, June of 64, I was hired at Ford's.
And you
I'd left Burroughs and the post office and went to Ford.
And you worked there until 78.
I worked there until 64, until 70, I believe. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then I went to Brownstown to this parts redistribution center.
I'm sorry, I thought that was also owned by Ford.
It is.
It is.
It's Ford. It's the we call it the mother hen. Everything that was made that went on a Ford product was shipped into this huge warehouse.
Okay.
Every car that Ford ever made, every part that ever went on it, we had some of it, or any other Ford product. You see. So we warehouse, we from the stamping plants. It was so large that we had four railroad spurs that housed five boxcars each. That was 20 boxcars could back in the house, had a train to push it in the house and close the doors. So you'd be, you know, out of the weather. Mm-hmm. And we unloaded all this material, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. Then we had 81 truck wells all lined up. And we used to unload something like 200-300 trucks a day and reload them. Unload these 20 boxcars of stamping plant material and reload them to go back out all over the country. And that was this daily project of receiving, storing, and shipping. And of course they had this sheet metal priming, which was all the sheet metal had to be primed in order to keep from rusting. So me having been at Highland Park as a paint coordinator, I went in as supervisor of this sheet metal processing line. And the line was, the actual running line was a mile long that went back and forth till it went through the process of washing and dipping and drying and unloading into racks to be stored, see. And of course you can imagine the millions and millions of parts that went through there.
So you worked there until 1978.
I worked there, and I was promoted from foreman to general foreman. And I still started going back to Wayne, taking courses and supervisor and whatnot, and psychology work. And I worked there, and I was acting superintendent, and had been at one time operations manager. I was the highest senior employee, so I had to run the whole plant, including security.
Was that your position when you left?
No, I was still general foreman. Okay. That was my title. I was supposed to have gone to superintendent.
Right. You were telling me a little bit
and
about
I don't
that.
Want to put that on record.
Okay, okay. Well, that wasn't the subject of this interview anyway.
But it was segregation again.
Right.
But from a different...
Hit the glass ceiling, so to speak.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Here. So from 1964 to 1978, you were...
I was at...
various jobs.
I was at Brownstown at Ford's.
Brownstown.
Brownstown, Michigan, at Ford. I was still at Ford.
And you moved from this position in the back all the way up to become general foreman.
Yeah.
Okay, that was something, some story.
Well, the first position was a tractor plant, see, and that's from the tractor plant I went to Brownstown, and then I got, moved on.
Moved on up.
And then, like I say, you called the glass ceiling, it's referred to after I ran into this situation, where a promotion was denied me. I decided to resign. I couldn't take it. I just didn't. When I have a feeling about something, I really have a feeling about something.
Right. So you resigned.
Yeah, I resigned, and I came here, came back home.
And you came back to Asheville.
Yeah.
Had you heard it was 1978? Then had you heard about the closing of Stevens Lee?
I had been here in several times to visit my people, my mother and my grandmother and all. And I think 75 I was here, and I'd heard some talk. I'd gone over there, and at that time it housed a lot of different social organization, opportunity programs or whatnot, and I went over and visited school, but it was intact. And somewhere after that it was demolished. I didn't really have clear knowledge of when it was torn down.
Right. Well, it was closed. The school.
The
part
school
of it
itself was closed. Was closed. It was being used as social offices.
And then it was demolished in 1975. But had you heard about that when it was originally closed in 1965?
That they were going to do that? No. I always thought that the school was only 42 years old. I always thought it would be used either as a junior high, a primary school, or something. Yes.
So how did that make you feel to find that it was closed?
Oh, good. I think, talking with my sister and all, and they had a few people here who tried to save it, but they decided they would take it down. They only left the gym. And Now that was turned over to the Parks and Recreation. I think some of the land was sold off up there to build homes. And then my understanding, they were going to use the rest of it to build more apartments or more homes or something. But yeah, that was a shocker. That was a shocker.
If they demolished it.
Yeah, when I came back in 78, yeah, it down.
Do you remember passing by it and not being there?
Oh, that's one of the places you went to see. You'd be out, you'd drive up around Stevens Lee. Yeah.
How did that feel?
Oh, like I say, not only with me, you could tell it the whole community. That was just talk. That's the only thing we talked about. But why did they tear Stevens Lee down? And especially people like myself who had lived away and were coming back. And they, oh, no. They told Steve, why did they do that? You know. And so it was quite a void.
Did you know at the time that you would become involved in this?
No, I didn't. One of our former teachers, Miss Lucille Pearson Burton, had tried to organize with former teachers and students some kind of program to save the school, and it had failed. And she heard that I was back in Asheville, and we talked. She's one of my she's a biology teacher. And the idea of starting an alumni association.
You two talked about that.
Yeah. And so she convinced me that I could do it. And she would remain as the counselor. And so I got together with my sister, Bruce Pagan, who just died here.
He just died.
That's last week. I just went to his funeral the other day. Yeah. Bruce Pagan. Ruby Jones, James Byrd, Corrine Smith, I think is the name now. And others were talking, but those, they served at the office, Henry Young and myself. And we had sort of like an ad hoc situation. We met people I knew, I got them to come to the meeting and all, and so I was elected ad hoc as a chairperson and all. And we got with these people, and we wrote up some bylaws, and then we called another meeting, advertised, and elected officers, and they elected me president in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And we did all kind of things. We had, no capital at all. And we'd meet at the Stevens Lee Community Center.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an up and down type of thing, not having too much to work with, not knowing really what to do. Talking with my sister, we were talking about a reunion, a class reunion. And we would decide, talking about maybe the class of 47 and 48 would go in and have one. It would be cheaper for individuals, and we could do it. And we always palled together anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Usually the class beneath us and the class above, we always was, you know.
Right.
So Marshall Logan had come back. He'd retired and come back to Asheville.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to him about this idea of classes getting together for a reunion. Maybe we ought to take it over a span of 5 years, you know. Within 5 years, he just... And he said, well... Yeah, that's a good idea. And let's expand it. What about the old school? Yeah. So that's how the school reunion came about. So now that was a job. How do you contact people who went to Stevens Lee when the school was demolished? The records were scattered out to UNCA, to the new Asheville High School. But we had people who committed to work, and they did. They went to the university and the archives, and they went to the schools. We interviewed people, and so we still did a few things here in town, had a few programs to keep the name out there, and we tried to do something to keep the name out and advertise. But it really took us we gave the event in 91.
So that was 1980 to 1991.
Yeah.
Who were the people that were doing that initial research? Was it some of the same people you've already
met? Well, my sister and myself.
Your sister Nadine.
Yeah, Clara Jeta. Some of her classmates, some of my classmates. But Nadine was instrumental because she had time to make contacts. I was working at Westinghouse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So she would make the contacts and appointments and, you know, mm-hmm. did the legwork for me.
Mm.
But I served as president up until that time.
Mm. The whole throughout the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then when 91 came, we had this grand reunion. It was well planned. And I think we had over 800 participants to come. Mm-hmm. Two came from Hawaii.
Wow.
And that was a 7-day event.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the mayor gave us the proclamation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was, yeah.
If we have time, we should read that on tape.
Yeah.
You were saying you guys did some interviews. Did you do any of those on tape?
I didn't, and I doubt if they did. I think it was just more one-on-one, mm-hmm. talking with teachers, ex-students, mm-hmm. People like Ray Lyles, like he was able to glean his class roster. The officers are spread over the whole spectrum of the years. Like Henry Young probably was back in the 30s when he graduated from Stevens Lee.
Mm-hmm.
Ruby was in the early 40s. I was the late 40s now. We hadn't been too able to get the younger students, though. The classes of 65, 64, they haven't been as...
That's still a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, they haven't been with it with participants. But they did a good job. We would get... We sent out 1,900, I think it was 1,950 letters went out the first time. Of course, a lot of them came back.
1,950 letters.
Yeah. A lot of them came back with deceased, wrong address, all that kind of thing. But out of that, we had 800 to attend.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
So is Miss Lucille Pearson Burton still alive?
She's deceased.
Okay. So when you first formed in 1980, what were the original goals of the association?
Oh, just about the same as it is now. Mm-hmm. We were going to our youth was the main thing. We were going to concentrate on the youth. We had hoped to foster recreational, civic, cultural activities.
Mm-hmm.
The scholarship thing was in our mind, but we didn't know how in the world we were going to ever get that to go. To aid the student. We just said to aid, and anyway, we could. Whether it be a tutoring program or whatnot. So over the period of time, from 90, after the 91 reunion, they went out a survey, and we asked people, take this home and ask, what do you want the alumni to do? And I still have some of the original returns, and I'd say 90% said, save Stevens Lee and scholarship program. Those were the two. And that was during my administration, so I took it upon me to, as a manifest, I had to do those two things.
When you say Stevens Lee, what was left?
The gymnasium. Because this is where all the activities was held. Now that the school was gone, we'd have our parties, our dances, our programs. We'd still go to Stevens Lee to the gym. But now it was in the parks and recreation. You know?
Right.
And it was deteriorating. They hadn't put any money in it. It was just going down, 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 down,
mm-hmm.
down. They'd do a little Band-Aid thing, you know, plumbing, Band-Aid, electrical, you know, and it was terrible. I think the whole idea there that eventually they were going to condemn it and demolish it.
Well, I understand from talking to Mr. Watts that you started attending city council meetings.
Oh, yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, these are the people you're going to need to aid you in doing anything. So I found out that Parks and Recreation came under the city management, which comes under city council. So I figured best I better talk to somebody on council. So, yes, I used to go to all the council meetings. And whenever the opportunity came to speak, I always spoke about the Stevens Lee.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, of course, you got all kind of roadblocks thrown there and stumbling blocks. Then I went to the newspapers. We started writing articles.
Mm-hmm.
Then at one time, I had a crew out at all the major supermarkets, stopping all the black shoppers, and asked them, would they sign this petition to save Stephen Lee? So in a month's time, we had 800 signatures and legitimate addresses, and I made copies and went to council meeting and got the floor. And I dropped a package off at each one of the councilman's desk and the city manager. And I said, this is only a portion of the citizen. Hmm. Then I went to the Jewish Community Center meetings. I went to some of the other political meetings, mm-hmm. you know, to get to know the people. And whenever I got a chance, I'd get up there, and I got to be allied with some of them. They allied themselves with us. And so just snowballed, just started. So that took about 3 years, though.
And you're talking about the early 90s now.
Oh, yes. From 91 up until 93, till we finally got a commitment. One council went out, a new council came in. We'd gotten a commitment from one council, which wasn't enough. So you go back to the new council. Then suddenly money was lost. It wasn't there. But whatever, you had to keep records.
I understand you had to go back to your records and show.
Oh, I used to keep records. I had a small tape recorder. I'd go to meetings. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whenever they had a political rally and all the candidates were there, I'd snip a note to the moderator that I had a question, and he'd let me stand up because being a minority, they wanted to show that at least they were from a minority. And I'd ask him, how do you feel about the renovation of Stephen Lee High School? And then I'd ask each one, and they had to stand up. And so each one of them stood up and said they were in favor of it. Well, that's all I wanted then. If you're in favor of it, then let's vote it in. So then
we... So what eventually happened?
It eventually happened.
Okay.
And then they throwed a block at us that they thought that that Stevens Lee alumni ought to contribute $100,000. And I told them that was absurd. That was double taxation. This was tax money. Why are you going to tax Stephen Lee alumni an additional $100,000 to do something you should have done years ago? And I said, no, you can't tax the alumni, but what the alumni will do, we will throw it open to the city. And we'll ask the city to aid us in refurbishing this place. And as a contribution, we'll put in $5,000, and we'll ask other organizations, the city. And so we did. And then we had a grant written, and the history of the school was written. Oh, yeah, we had to get it declared historical first, mm-hmm. to save the grounds,
right.
even before you could do anything with it. And so that process went through about a year and a half. But when we finally got it down and finally got the history in written form, we were able to go to council then and say that we want it declared historical, which they did. Then we asked the city to contribute toward this. Then a grant was written from Parks and Recreation to the state Parks and Recreation. And this information, the history and all the material I gave, went in. And in a very short time, the state allotted us $250,000.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We already had about $1,650,000
from the city
and from contributions or whatever.
So I have one last question for you before we run out of time here. So currently, as a result, Stevens Lee is being... Okay, the question is this. So Stevens Lee is being renovated. The city is committed to restoring a room specifically for the Stevens Lee High School heritage. What would you most like people to remember and know about Stevens Lee High School in this new community center?
What it stood for, what it was, what it meant to a student to have gone through those doors, whether they graduated or not. If they spent any time up on the hill, they received something. The contributions that the students have made, God, the list would be enormous if I could tell you the contributions that students that went through Stevens Lee. And because of that beginning, because of that interest, you know, they were able to go on, although they went outside the state to other places to get higher education. And some returned here to A&T College and to North Carolina State. You know, the contributions made by the students even here in the city of Asheville. It's just amazing. And I wanted that to be preserved. Hopefully that our young people, this will rub off. They know nothing of this. They know nothing of this. There were times, of course, now our students came from 60 miles away sometimes, but you'd graduate a class of 125, 150, maybe some larger. And you hear now that out of 400 students graduating from Asheville High, maybe 29 are black. So many drop out, 600-700 start school, and wind up with 200 in a senior class. And then those that that walk across the stage, I'm always given a diploma. They tell me sometimes it's a blank paper. They have to come back to summer school to take some remedial courses. Well, this is absurd.
Yeah.
If we did it back in those particular days,
mm-hmm.
it should be better now. There should be more coming out.
Right.
They should even be smarter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the advantages are greater. But something is blocking something. We want to keep alive what we had and hopefully instill in them to do that, to do better.
Thank you very much, Mr. Parrish.
Well, thank you, Ms. Navis. It's a pleasure.